Welcome to another edition of Beyond the Policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carell. I'm joined today by Stuart Winchester, the founder and CEO of Marvel. Like many aspiring founders, Stuart listened to his fair share of How I Built This episodes prior to taking the plunge himself. But as a first-time founder, Stuart was more captivated by a blog post of how a startup didn't pan out. That blog post, Reflections of a Failed Startup, was written by Sam Stone in 2019. It chronicles the journey of a startup that enjoys some initial success, but ultimately missed the signs of its own downfall. One aspect that caught Stuart's attention is the concept of team beats problem beats solution, and how it informs Marvel's culture and team building today. So much so that the blog post is now required reading as part of new team member onboarding. We dive deeper into how Marvel's culture building is centered around transparency and healthy debate. We also spend some time outlining how listeners can implement their own version of team beats problem beats solution in their own business. We then wrap up by sharing signs to look out for when your business is not performing well and ways in which you can right the ship. After the episode is over, please check out howyouinsurethat.com for our entire catalog of previous episodes. Now, please enjoy my conversation with Stuart Winchester, CEO of Marvel. Stuart, thanks for stopping by today.
Hey, pretty good. Thanks. I just wanted to dive in. You sent me this fascinating blog post the other day, and you said that it really resonated with you. And after reading it, I knew I had to have you on the show to dive into it. That post is called Reflections of a Failed Startup. And it was written by the co-founder of Ansaro, Sam Stone. Now, just to tee up what this article is, there's a podcast that we all know and love, How I Built This, massive following. And you even told me that this was something that you listened to pretty frequently as you were on the path to finding Marvel. But that show really focuses on successful startups and the lessons that Guy Raz takes out of those founders are phenomenal. But me personally, I always want to hear more from the founders, from the startups who didn't make it. And I think those lessons are equally, if not more valuable. So first, I wanted to ask you, do you feel there's a stigma around startups that don't survive? And then two, how did this post, this Reflections of a Failed Startup post, how did that so profoundly affect you?
I'll avoid too much lead in, and I'll just try and get to your first question, which is the stigma, because it's like, it's something obviously I think about a lot. I think, you know, a lot of people, not exclusive to founders, I think basically people who are join companies, Series A, Series B, even weigh that. You could go work at IBM and the lights are going to stay on every day. And I've worked at some Series D and later companies where publicly everything is awesome, a lot of headlines, and privately you tap your key card in the morning and we're still doing the show. So maybe the point of that is it's much more pervasive than even someone from the outside might think. Someone from the outside might think you're working in the garage, you don't know if you're going to make it, but you get that office, you get that fundraising, and now you're good. And it's, now that precarity can be there for a long time, especially if you're taking big swings. But I think the stigma exists, but I think it also really depends on how it goes down. Founding space to make it a little bit more supportive if ventures don't succeed or don't work out. That being said, as a founder, I really can't imagine anything, and I grapple with this all the time. I'm constantly stressed out by what I can do for the team. And this gets into a little bit of what Sam wrote about too, but it's, my concern is far less about my ego. It's much more about making sure that people have a good career with us and a good thing on their resume. So I don't know if that's stigma, but that's what I stress out about. And then, to get into the piece. So yes, exactly what we talked about before. I listened to How I Built This, I think the entire month of December before we officially like formed Marvel, just to get into that mindset. I worked at General Assembly. I worked at Better. I worked at a lot of startups, but I never worked anywhere from zero to one. And 100% what you said. Cool stories, typically about halfway through the episode, they talk about a bumpy part, but they always make it. And then eventually I was Googling around and I found this Medium piece. And I don't actually, I don't ever talk to Sam Stone. I don't know him, but I just, the piece is so well written. It's so thoughtful and it's so frank in its assessment of what went wrong that actually it's part of onboarding. Now for the early team, we ask everyone at Marvel, it's to read it, because it clearly lays out a path for how to operate with failure as an option and with the lessons of failure in mind.
I think that's really fascinating. First and foremost, just what a cool place the internet is, that you can write something about an event that happened now under recording this 12 years ago. The company shut down in 2009 and Google just lays it out for you. And it Google has no idea that this is what you need in your life, but here it is 12 years later and you're recommending this as a piece of new hire onboarding material.
I wonder how much traffic this media post is getting from just our Notion onboarding document right now.
I know, right? Sam, if you're listening, please give Stuart a call. And I'm sure that would be a fantastic conversation. So going back to that piece in the onboarding, has that had the effect that you intended on your new hires on your early team?
I think so. And particularly the team beats prom beats solution. That is something that... If anyone who's in the Marvel Slack will see, we use a lot of exclamation marks. I think we try to be really positive and assume best intent, but that does not come at the expense of frank disagreement, proactive flag throwing if someone's concerned, and I would say not total buy-in on the vision I'm selling. And maybe if an investor listens to this, they'll be, I need total buy-in from the team. But I've worked at companies with true believers, and that can paint over some structural issues. And in recent memory, we have taken ideas, features, products, improvements that have been in my brain or someone else's brain, have developed this momentum that can happen at a startup where it snowballs and everyone's, oh, that's cool. That's so cool. And then very fortunately, someone, before we ship it or before we put the biggest investment, which is typically starting to develop it, will throw a flag and be like, hold up, I actually don't buy this. And it has saved us money and has also saved us time. And I'm, you know, close with a lot of other founders, as you can imagine, as I'm sure you are too. And money and time are what you got, because with money and time, you can find traction, you can pivot stuff. So we've been very fortunate to have this culture of, again, supportiveness, best intent assumed, but really inspired by Team Meets Problem Solution, a team that will throw a flag and be like, I don't agree with this. It's not because I dislike you or I don't think you're smart or well-driven, but did you consider this? And when you have that trust and culture built around critique, people will hear that and not get defensive. I agree, let's shelve it and build this instead. So it has had that effect in a very measurable way.
When it comes to that culture building, I've seen companies where the all hands meeting, the investor calls, very, very rosy, talking about these great things and these great culture building. But when it comes down to the day to day, when it comes down to those teams actually building and executing, sometimes there is just not that true adoption. Oh yeah, they said that at the all hands, but let's be real, that is not how this team operates. How do you model that for your team to show that I'm saying this and I believe it? How do you model that to make them comfortable that they can't take that chance?
It's a very good question, because we just were talking about this. This is very passe, maybe now. I love Slack, man. I know that's, it feels like came out of 2007 saying that, but or whatever it was founded. First of all, fellow Stuart founded it. So there's not many of us, we're a dying breed. So I respect that. Two, we just use everything routes through Slack. We're a remote team now. I've asked the team and they've met me what I've asked, and we roll anything you can push into a public channel, push it there. The corollary to that, or the understanding of that, is I will be very upfront about things that we can't put there. I'm not going to put I'll put forecasts in there, but I'm not going to put the full forecasting model, because that has salaries and that's just, you know, not appropriate to share. So I think the first intent is please bias towards public channels. Second is explain why some things might not be shared. And that, I hope, builds trust, builds communication muscles, builds autonomy, and lowers temperature of defensiveness. Because again, I think we've talked about this, or you just alluded to this in these all hands too, when the expectation is that things are all rosy, when something goes wrong, you can find people scrambling to... So one of the other principles during onboarding we have is no surprises. I will never be mad if someone throws a flag early, I will only be mad, whatever that means, if it's the last second and someone hit it from me. And again, this is a rambling answer to say, we just try to role model it by me, Isabel, who runs marketing, Adi, who runs technology and product, even at the senior level, throw it into public channels. Put it there so anyone can see it. And if it has to go private, be like, hey, we're taking this to a sidebar because it involves PII or it involves whatever, stuff like that.
I wanted to dive a little deeper into the flags that have been thrown without like not revealing any details that you wouldn't want in the public sphere. But what obstacles have you avoided by adopting this approach to, you know, fostering an environment that invites disagreement and raising flags? What are some things that you've been able to avoid by doing that? What are those successes look like?
We just had one 2 weeks ago. So this is a great time to talk about it actually. And I'll be a little bit high level, but hopefully pretty actionable too. We, MarlPay.com, our consumer product, we have a basically personal ecosystem for insurance, trying to build the first user first insurance program, not product first. So you can come in, anyone can come in, make an account, sync all your insurance. Today, the wallet is very policy first. And what that means is when you sync things, you get your policies stacked up. You can see the due dates, the payments, the coverages. We have a tremendous consulting advisor, Matthew Stevens, who used to run Design at the Zebra. We've been collaborating with him from our brain, but with his implementation on changing how that wallet, maybe we bring in some assets, show the vehicles that are insured, show the house, things like that. And he created a month ago this phenomenal architecture for that, like visual architecture for that. And we were, because you have a designer that good, you get so, designs are so much fun. I've joked about like, founders, I'm always in Figma and people are like, get out. And I'm so fun. This is, could look all so good. We were on this path. And I think our product manager, Arpin, started to pull apart the infrastructure realities of this build out, the onboarding realities, because again, it might not yet match what consumers expect if we change how it looks. There was just a lot of considerations that the excitement of this beautiful and really differentiated design had painted over. And Arpin threw a flag. We got on, he was like, hey, can we chat this through? And we said, this needs to bake more. We need to survey and interview a lot more users to figure this out. And we have some other projects on the back burner. We're going to slot those in. We're not going to lose velocity. And I think the moment we made that decision, not to stop it, but just to pause it and bake it a little bit more, we were all, wow. It was like, that was the choice. We weren't quite ready for this. And I just had this, sometimes you like have these moments in your life where you're like, wow, what if that other thing had happened? And I could have seen this world where we could have shipped this awesome design, innovative view, but conversion just tanked. And we're an early stage company. A bad month of conversion would mean we would have to just wind the whole thing back. So we got really fortunate there to have that culture.
You had mentioned that this culture is something of your de-risking superpower. This is the team beats the problem, beats solution. It is a way that you de-risk your organization. Tell me about that. What does that mean to you? How does this de-risk Marble?
I think I've had the opportunity, I know I've had the opportunity to work with truly visionary founders who are at a place both in their personal and professional career and their conviction where through force of will and charisma are able to take ideas that would not demonstrate true product market fit and get them funded until they find product market fit. I think we can all think of examples. Yeah, there are many. Some of them are publicly listed already. I don't know that I have that. I'm a first-time founder. I've worked at startups before, but I'm a first-time founder. We are tackling something very squishy in a very squishy regulated space. How do you get people to engage with their insurance? Insurance is boring for most people. There's a lot of challenges there. I could get up and be like, we are going to create a $10 billion company. I just don't know that's how I want to do business. And I don't know that I could sell it well enough. So the de-risking is find 10 to 15 of like the best, smartest people who are empowered to throw flags, who buy in to the, let's say, opportunity, $1 trillion industry. Insurance is a very interesting space. 43% of Americans keep their insurance in paper or PDF. The fundamentals are there, are of a great problem to solve. But everyone is empowered to be like, I think I don't buy your solution yet. And that's our de-risking mechanism, because we're going to need a really good solution if we're going to raise money, because I don't think I can just do it on a charm alone.
I don't know, Stuart. I think you're selling yourself short there.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, if you see me post on LinkedIn a lot, it means we're not getting the metrics we need. I'm going the other way.
This concept of team beats problem beats solution, to unpack that a little bit more, is you're looking to build a team that buys into a sector or an industry that has some problems. And you, for example, insurance, you're building a team that believes that there's a fundamental opportunity to change insurance for the better. That team is built of people who respect each other, that are not afraid to disagree. And through team building,
but disagreement is a thin knife edge, because if the goal is just to disagree, then you get a culture where people think they win points by publicly disagreeing. If the goal is more users, cheaper acquisition, more engagement, more revenue, but the met one tact to get there is frank and respectful disagreement, that's great. If it's just disagreeing in front of the boss because you think he or she likes that, then it's a classic vicious or virtuous cycle. One is just going to lead to more disagreement and more defensiveness, and one is going to lead to hopefully better product. If you see that happening, it's, I don't know, in my mind, it's basically what I try to do is I try to be pretty involved if there are disagreements, just to not referee, but try to get a smell test if they're sincere or if it's something else.
From that respectful disagreement, you want progress towards a shared goal, and you're identifying that problem. So at Marble now, in your current iteration, you're building this wallet to house a user's insurance policies, to manage it in that one place. What were some potential solutions that got beat out by where you're at now? This going from problem to solution, there's probably solutions that got left behind. Can you talk about some of those and maybe how this process maybe saved you from going down that road before? You talked about a previous example, but just curious, before you land on this, how did that work for you?
So I get two things come to mind. One is Ade, our CTO, through one of the first flags that we ever used to save a lot of time. But early 2020, I was in this room, we were on Zoom, and we were pretty committed to this really shopping forward product, really pushing rate tabling, using this wallet, but really drive most of the roadmap was about integrating multiple shopping partners, standing up an agency, normalizing quotes, which is heavy duty lifting. And it's a 2-year roadmap. I mean, that's what I did it better. And I think Ade threw this flag early that has been instructive for us, which was basically, hey, a lot of companies have done that really well already. There's dozens of them who are super well capitalized. Is that a path forward? Is that a viable path forward? And is that what really users would come, are they coming online to solve that problem anymore? And again, that was like a, oh wow moment where we were like, no, that's, we need to take this research we've done hours and hours interviewing, go through it and pick out other themes, control, organization. Do I have the best coverage? What is my coverage? How do I share documents? Some shopping. And build something that is like useful, but build something that doesn't exist today, because clearly users are still craving something from insurance. There's not massive user satisfaction with online insurance, but the Gabbies of the world, policyholders, have already done a great job at the shopping. We're not going to correct. We were 3 years too late and $100 million undercapitalized. So I think that's even the most foundational one, where early flag led to us taking what I would say, I think the metrics have backed it up, the correct, I don't want to say pivot, correct path forward.
From there, I wanted to pivot into taking the lens away from Marble and looking outward and talking to founders that are in similar positions as you, maybe earlier on, that maybe haven't adopted this team beats problem beats solution, but after finding it and researching it, maybe sounds like something that resonates with them. What advice would you give to a founder who's looking to make that pivot, like in their thinking, we've talked about the benefits to it, but fundamentally, how did you implement that?
We have a great team who have all been here for a while, but our two more senior hires, Adi and Isabel, CTO, head of marketing. I interviewed a lot of CTOs when we were looking for to make that hire. And Adi is a tremendous CTO and was running his own CTO for hire practice. But where Adi really stood out from everyone else is that we almost immediately started building a trust relationship. We had a lot in common. We had great communication rapport. I felt very early that we could have unfiltered communication. And as someone who stresses a lot about how I come off to people and I want to make sure people, me and I want to make sure, I felt like I had a quick ability based on Adi's personality to be more authentic. And I don't know how to make that sound less squishy, but I think it's just, I would trust people to get that feeling when you're, are you talking to someone, you're more reserved or you're really thinking in your head, or when, what is the path between brain and mouth? Straight up, you know, this is our third time working together. We are basically a package deal in many ways. We worked at GA together. We worked at Better together. I just totally trust her. And I would say if you're looking to make that pivot, and I talk to a lot of founders who have indexed more for resume and logos and skill, which is great, and has a place in everything. There's no causation I can draw, but that correlation is that doesn't always correlate to a culture of velocity, even though you would think someone with these logos in the resume might get you more velocity. Trust, in my experience, gets you more velocity because there's autonomy, there's disagree and commit, there is just trusting and going a little bit further out in the scaffolding without needing the answer. There's a lot less revisiting decisions, which is a thing that can happen if there's no trust and kills velocity. So find one or two people who can role model and seed a culture of trust. You might not even need them to fill a functional role you need. Maybe as a CEO, you're already doing some marketing. I got marketing, you know, before seed. But you've worked with a phenomenal marketer who you trust, or a PM, or a copywriter. It doesn't even have to be someone that senior. Someone you can bring in and be like, we now can form a little bit of a molecule of trust here, and we can just be in Slack, and we can role model, and that is that's what I would do. It's what I have done. This is not how I built this. We're not public, people can say, well, I'll take his advice after they exit, but it's worked well for us.
My last question here, as far as actionable advice, I always think that before the startup ceases to exist, there's got to be some signs along the way. This is not just something that you said, you as a CEO are not going to tap your key card on the card reader and it's just not going to open up for you. Before you get there, what are some signs that you would point out that are maybe some guide markers that should perk you up and say, maybe this isn't working. This feels we're going down an ominous path. What are you looking for there? And even more importantly, if you recognize those signs, how can you recover from that? How can you steer it back?
I think the first thing I would say just off the bat, do what business you are on a cash in hand level. So are you a business that is able to generate enough cash that your runway is not strictly dependent on outside investment? So the checkbook.io, I think, they just raised a Series A, and PJ, I think their founder, CEO, wrote a great blog post. And he talked about Checkbook's a SaaS business, low marketing costs. I recommend everyone go read it. It's on LinkedIn. He talked about they went out for a fundraise, didn't get a great reception from the market, and they were able to turn back inwards and ratchet down costs, ratchet up pricing, and create a cash flow positive business. We're an in-betweener, Marvel. We have an enterprise business that could get us cash flow positive, but we have this consumer business, which is very cash flow intensive, right? Or any of these consumer businesses. These are businesses that need VC infusion until they become market dominant. And I think you got to know which one you are, because that totally informs when you need to run a flag up the flagpole, to keep this flag analogy going, and say, we got to make a decision. So what I look at revenue projections. I built a very overly complex model. I used to be a financial consultant. One nice note is I know my model is good because I've had other founders send it to me, which means that other VCs are sending my model around as a template, which is a little annoying, but whatever. It's a compliment.
It's flattering.
It is flattering. It's also like a total breach of whatever I thought they were doing, but that's fine. So I have a pretty good sense of our down to the week, you know, runway. And then, yeah, how do you, I would say add 2 months to whatever decision point you come to. So if you need to, if you think you need to decide in January, you should really be deciding in November because everything takes longer to pivot. Just add margin. And again, sorry, I'm rambling, but to get really tactical, if you are a cash flow positive, if you're a business that can't get cash flow positive, when you hit that mark, that 2 month before the month mark, commit to the pivot. Or whatever it is, commit to the break glass. We call it internally our break glass strategy. So is it going to be headcount reduction, price improvements, sell, pre-book revenue, and try to get cash flow positive and control your own destiny? Or is it going to be get out to the market, raise a down round, look at us, you know, look at raising debt. And if you're doing that second one where you rely on VC capital, you have to know what they're looking for. I think it's very in vogue maybe now, especially if you're on Twitter as a founder, which I don't recommend. I'm on it all the time. It's horrible to be, oh, everyone's raising money. I don't need to talk to VCs. They'll just turn the money hose on because that's what Pipe is doing or that's what Ramp is doing. Fortunately, it's not the case. Really good companies are getting funded. Everyone else, it's still tough out there. And I think you need to have you need to be in close communication, feeling out the market, because the worst thing that can happen is you step off the ledge and start raising and companies are, and VCs are, you had, this is a huge miss. Oh my God. Cause that is, there's not, again, if you don't have a path to cash flow profitability, you've lost control. You just need to, you'll probably have to do a down round.
Well, one follow-up question there. You had mentioned know what VCs are looking for.
I wish I knew. No, I think crypto is very hot. It's not something that I touch, but there it is. I think for consumer business. So I think in two broad buckets, you can look at businesses. Some VCs don't want to touch consumer. Some VCs focus on consumer. That's maybe too obvious a starting point, but it's helpful to know that. I didn't know that when I started. And you talk, you know, I pitched the Marble consumer business and you'd have these VCs that they're only focused on SaaS companies. And they'd be like, it's not really for us. So having a tight view of who you're talking to and what you're selling. So are you selling consumer business? Okay. Consumer VCs are probably going to be looking at brand, probably going to be looking at organic traction, probably going to be looking for novel acquisition tactics that are not Facebook or Google. Back.
Yep, Andrew, here you are.
Okay,
yeah, sorry. I got you.
Cool. I will go back into that and say VCs are probably looking on the consumer side for brand, organic traction, some acquisition tactics that are not relying on Facebook or Google. I just tweeted about this. It's very hard to get those that will actually scale. They're looking for a path to LTV that is something differentiated. Did I just drop again?
Nope. I got you.
Okay, cool. The organic engagement. The SaaS players are looking for a great SaaS product that can just scale to $1 billion market cap, I think. So for us, our story is going to be, and I'm happy to share this, we'll be out in the new year, probably fundraising, but our story is going to be something along the lines of our CAC is crazy efficient. We have something differentiated. We have a lot of opportunities on the consumer side. And then we have a SaaS product that we think can just be used by every insurance carrier in the US. So you just want to have that combination of scale and good fundamental metrics. Of course, there are fads and trends. I'll leave it there. I don't want to ascribe anything to a fad or trend because then they'll get bad.
No worries. Yeah, that those have an interesting way of aging.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't want to be the one, much like making any predictions about insurtech acquisitions, I don't want to get in the business of predicting which one is a fad and which one's sticking, because then I'll get, you know, then I put it on the record.
There you go. No, that's a good way to de-risk that approach.
Yeah, exactly. Just don't commit to anything. Very political.
There you go. Hey, Stuart, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, what do you got going on these days? Anything that you want to share with the greater public?
We would love to get more people on the consumer platform, particularly if you feel if you're an insurance professional or just someone with insurance, we have this whole ambassador program. We've signed up 50 of our users who just, they're in an upvotey platform with us. We have a little forum for them and they can like go back and forth with me and the team and suggest features. We really need to lean on community from our world because we're trying to build stuff that isn't shopping and trust the shopping businesses to be the experts on that. And it takes a lot to figure out what we can build for people. But when we do, it's bang, it's awesome. So the wallet was our first hit. These double verified reviews for Insurance Insider, where we only show reviews of carriers from people who have active policies from that carrier, huge hit. But we want to figure out the next. And we have a couple ideas, but if people do want to get in the mix with us, that is, it's fun. We send cool swag. So join us and volunteer for the ambassador program. And then for your listeners that are in the insurance carrier or MGA broker space, keep an eye out. We have our first enterprise rewards program launching at the beginning of December. It's going to be big. It's going to be national. And we have a couple scheduled, but we're always looking to add more people into the queue to build these cool rewards programs. So yeah, those are the two things we have going on. And then if anyone in the insurtech industry or you yourself, Andrew, are ever in New York, I've been seeing on Twitter, all the VCs are coming back to New York, but I've been here the whole time. So just hit me up so we can hang out.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's awesome. Yeah. Thanks, Stuart. This has been an absolutely fantastic conversation. I appreciate you coming on today.
Awesome. Andrew, thank you so much for having me.
That does it for this episode of Beyond the Policy. If you've missed prior episodes and want to catch up, please visit us at howyouinsurethat.com. Again, that's howyouinsurethat.com. And to never miss an episode in the future, please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you download and listen to shows. Until next time, thanks for joining us and stay risky.